You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is Larry List, a New York-based curator and artist who's been engaged for years with artists and composers whose works and indeed lives have involved chess. We talk primarily this evening about List as curator of the Imagery of Chess Revisited, an exhibition that recreated a show that originally took place at the Julian Levy Gallery in New York City in 1944. List's recreation took place at the Noguchi Museum in Long Island City, New York in 2005-2006, and its artists included Alexander Calder, Noguchi himself, Robert Motherwell, André Breton, Marcel Duchamp, Max Ernst, Man Ray, Dorothea Tanning, and other leading surrealists, including Cage's wife of the time, Xenia. In point of fact, according to List, Cage was not initially invited to contribute to the 1944 show, but managed to wiggle in on the coattails of his wife, a strikingly original artist herself, best known for her delicate mobiles. Their two contributed works to be somehow conjoined within the exhibition. Cage's contribution to the 1944 Levy Gallery show was a work made especially for it, Chess Pieces, originally conceived as an ink and gouache array of black and white music notation that filled an array of squares on a 19 by 19 inch Masonite board. In List's preparatory work for the Imagery of Chess Revisited, he managed to locate, borrow, and then closely examine virtually all of the works from the original show, including Cage's. Soliciting the expertise of the well-known Cage pianist, Margaret Lang Tan, it was discovered that Chess Pieces was not only a compelling visual artwork, but also a coherent musical composition, a through-composed score consisting of 22 systems of music read conventionally from left to right. Each system was found to be a self-contained musical unit of 12 bars, translating collectively into 22 modular segments. Lang Tan subsequently recorded the work, and thus Chess Pieces was both exhibited and first heard at the Imagery of Chess Revisited exhibition in the Noguchi Museum in Long Island City. As Lang Tan rightly observed, Chess Pieces stands at the confluences of three of John Cage's primary lifelong interests, music, visual arts, and chess. The original score, as visual artwork, remains in a private collection in Chicago. The transcription made by Lang Tan for solo piano is available from John Cage's music publisher, C.F. Peters. So welcome to All Things Cage, Larry. It's great to be with you.
Oh, thank you, Laura. It's nice to talk with you.
Larry, you have the distinction of being, well, I shouldn't say this. I'm not going to say that. I'm going to ask you whether or not you're a chess player.
I play well enough to be able to appreciate the genius of others, of professional players. Mm-hmm. And so I enjoy watching great players play, and I marvel at the beauty of what they create. But I'm not a great chess player personally, no.
Me neither. Did you see The Queen's Gambit?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Wasn't that a fabulous movie?
I think they did a very good job of it. Yes, very
Me
good.
Too. So what I was going to say is correct. I was going to say that I've known in the last, say, 20, 25 years, I've known a number of people who were close to Cage, very knowledgeable about Cage's chess work, but they were all players. They were people who played with him. And you were the first person actually that I'd met who had had such an extended period of time with Cage's chess-related works, let's say. So my first question, I guess, to you is whether or not it's true that in 2000, that was when you were invited by the Isamu Noguchi Museum to, well, you tell us. So what happened in 2000?
Well, I was invited by the museum to research and organize an exhibition and a book to reassemble all the works from a legendary but little known 1944 group exhibition at the Julian Levy Gallery called The Imagery of Chess.
That was in Chicago or New York?
It was in New York.
Okay.
Yeah. And Noguchi was central in a way because he knew both all the expatriate surrealists who were sheltering in New York and loved playing chess. And he also was good friends with the young New York painters who were aspiring to rule the kingdom of the arts. And so he was kind of the central figure in a way, and it was a nice opportunity to show him in the context of all these other artists.
I see. How old was a man was this? Was he like Cage's age?
Noguchi?
No. Oh. Julian Levy.
Oh, Julian Levy. He was around the same age. You know, they were old enough to be adults, but they were still young and restless and quite mischievous.
Yeah.
Both professionally and personally.
Interesting. And when you said yes, how aware were you of the works that had been in that show, the imagery of chess? And were you conscious of Cage at that point?
Well, I was generally aware of John Cage, absolutely. As far as the works in the show, what led to the show is I was tasked with tracking down sort of a little chess table that Noguchi had designed and was briefly produced for 3 years by Herman Miller. And well, why did he make a chess table? And then why was it so rare? And they'd just been given money to actually start acquiring his furniture. So I was asked to track this down. We want to buy one. And fortunately, one came up for auction. And I was sent with the curator, and the trustee instructed me, I am to keep elbowing her until she keeps bidding and gets the damn thing, which she did. Mm-hmm. But then we had this wonderful thing. Well, but then wait a second, why did he make this? And so I was tasked with, well, why did he make it? And in the process, I discovered he made it specifically for this group show. Uh-huh. And he also made a plexiglass chess set, very experimental material at the time, plexiglass chess set. And that had never turned up. And so I was then tasked because I was trained as a studio artist and I built models and prototypes as well as my art stuff. And I was tasked to reverse engineer from two little drawings what this chess set looked like and make a replica set to go with the table. And so in the process, I researched and, oh, it was this whole group show. And, oh, look, all of his surrealist friends from Paris were there and all the young New Yorkers. And they said, well, we always show Noguchi as a lone figure. And this would be an opportunity for us to show him in the context of a wide variety of the art world. So I was then assigned that you're going to be the first guest curator in the Noguchi Museum. So go do this.
And Larry, was it the case that most of the people who exhibited in the show made work for that exhibit, or were there things that were extant that were brought in?
Yeah, there are a few extant pieces, though I would say that most of the people who were in the show loved playing chess. And so there was an avid interest in chess. And that's what sparked the show, actually. Julian Levy and Max Ernst were sharing a house for the summer of 1944 out on Long Island with their girlfriends, soon to be wives. They started making chess sets and they thought, this is great. We should have everybody make chess sets. So they invited everybody to make chess sets or chess related art. And so that's how the whole thing started. And they invited 32 people, just like 32 chess pieces, and off they went. And Duchamp, of course, was intimately involved with this. And so it was Duchamp, Julian Levy, and Max Ernst.
Right. For our listening audience, this might be known pretty generally to everybody, but Duchamp was really Cage's chess teacher for a good period of his early adulthood.
Yes.
Cage was enamored with Duchamp, and Duchamp used to get so angry with him because he accused Cage of not trying to win. That Cage admitted it, that he really used the game of chess with Marcel Duchamp to just be with him because he loved him.
Yes. Yeah. He and Tini both.
Exactly. Well, Tini, he and Tini Duchamp were really close. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the genesis of the show, both the original show and then the show that I did for the Noguchi Museum. And then it moved to the Manil Collection in Houston. which was great and a nice fit for them because of their strong support and their big collection of surrealist works.
Of course, of course. And again, for our listening audience, the show at the Levy Gallery was called The Imagery of Chess. This was 1944. And now we are fast forwarding to 2000. Larry is now curating a new iteration of this show called The Imagery of Chess Revisited at the Osamu Noguchi Museum. What was the hardest part? Well, let's just talk about Cage, actually, because it's an interesting story. So did you have trouble tracking down that work?
Fortunately, I went through the gallery ledger and I saw that it was listed and it had been sold to the husband of one of Cage's earliest supporters, Rue Shaw of the Chicago Arts Club. Once I knew what I was looking for, I was able to find it. It had been exhibited a couple of times before, so I was able to find it. What was amazing, though, was John Cage wasn't invited to be part of the show. His then wife, Xenia Cage, who was a sculptor, had done a show with Julian Levy of her mobile sculptures, these thin, diaphanous, delicate things that hung and primarily were designed to create beautiful cast shadows on walls. She was invited, and John sort of wanted to piggyback in because he liked everybody and wanted to be a part of things.
And is it true, Larry, that you didn't know that Cage had been married?
That is true. Yes. I wasn't aware of Xenia, but once I knew of Xenia, I was able to track down her work from an auction catalog because she created this beautiful chess table. And the chess table sort of ended up being owned by Julian Levy along with the Max Ernst chess set. And through the good offices of Dorothea Tanning, I was introduced to the person who now owned the chess table and the Max Ernst chess set. And it was beautiful, it was well taken care of, but it was so delicate that it couldn't be moved. And so I got permission to make a museum replica of it. And when I measured the thing to make the replica, I realized that the top dimensions, 19 by 19, were the exact same dimensions as John Cage's chess piece painting that he did on Masonite, that he painted sort of a gray background, and then he alternated squares of a calligraphic musical score in white ink and black ink, white ink, black ink, to optically create the illusion of a chessboard. So
right. People should know, our listeners should know, that they can see an image of this piece, which is called Chess Pieces. We bandied that title back and forth when we're talking, but that is the title of Cage's piece. It's called Chess Pieces, and there'll be a significance to this in a second. But you can see a picture of that work on our broadcast page for this show.
Yeah. And so, well, did John offer to make the chessboard for Xenia's chess table? But it didn't end up sort of on Xenia's chess table. It ended up sort of on the wall in a frame. And what did end up on the chess table was a watercolor and gouache chessboard by Max Ernst. And sitting on top of that was sort of Max Ernst's chess set. And what is maybe interesting sort of about that is, as I alluded to, they were all young and restless. And at that point, Xenia and John had been married for 10 years. And John had come to the realization that his true affection was for Merce Cunningham. And so he and Xenia were parting. It was very acrimonious. And Xenia was very strong-willed, sexually adventuresome person, and not to be denied. Sort of. And on Long Island that summer, everybody lived just a bike ride or a walk away from each other. And John and Xenia were living across the street from Robert Motherwell, who was Max Ernst's chess partner. And so it could be that Max Ernst, who never missed an opportunity to offer his affections to women, might have offered to comfort Xenia Cage. And so that's why perhaps it's his chess set and his chessboard that is on Xenia Cage's table.
That's very sweet. For our listening audience, that it was Max Ernst and Peggy Guggenheim who, when Cage and Xenia came to New York for the first time, when they moved to New York, from Chicago, which is why I was asking about Chicago, because I wasn't sure where this all happened. But they moved to New York and had been invited to stay with Peggy and Max. And there's that very funny story where they arrive in New York and they telephone and they have a quarter in their pocket and they call and Max Ernst doesn't know who they are. Says, I'm sorry, what?
Right.
Who are you?
And, yes.
And then they call back with their last dime.
Yes. No, they had met Max in Chicago at Rue Shaw's because she gave him a show. And he said, oh, well, if you're in New York, you must come and visit us.
Yes.
As he said to everybody. And so they did come and visit. And actually, sort of the Guggenheim Ernst sort of like duplex was well known for drunken dinner parties where people ended up swapping partners. And so while they were there, Xenia and Max had swapped with each other at least once. And so that may have been the pretext for this summertime thing that happened with changing chessboards, et cetera, et cetera. And Max's great sculptor, The King Playing with the Queen, it portrays sort of this tall chess queen out in front with the king sort of sheltering it with a hand. And Dorothea Tanning was taller than Max Ernst. And so he made the chess queen in his chess set taller than the king to honor her. But then the king's other hand is behind his back where he's hiding a smaller vanquished looking queen figure. And Xenia, who was shorter than Max, could be represented by this hidden, vanquished little queen. So that may be the story. Nobody wrote it down and did diagrams and letters and figures to do that, but it does sort of explicate, you know, an initiative sort of, why do you put these things where you put them? So that was sort of one kind of discovery sort of in the process of things that gave reason to the supposedly unreasonable or irrational surrealist work.
Interesting. So Cage's, going back to Cage's work, we've got this, I think it's 19 by 19, is that true?
Yes.
Yes, 19 by 19 inch chessboard, shaped object, not really chessboard shaped object, but the dimensions of the work are reasonably a chessboard. And it's done with gouache, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With alternating squares, with music manuscript in each square, seemingly unrelated, seemingly has a kind of blue and silverish hue alternating.
Yes.
And I don't know what else to say about it at this point, but it mimics a chessboard.
Yes.
And so maybe fast forwarding in this show, which you can read about, you'll get the catalog. You can still obtain this and you can read all about it in the Imagery of Chess Revisited catalog. From that show was 2000, was that 2006?
2005 and 2006.
Okay.
And
that catalog, I think, is still available, is it not?
Yes, it's still, all these years later, it's still in print. There are copies out there that you can get both new and used. And it seems as though sort of it's had a long life, which is
exactly
great.
Exactly. And there's also, I want to say that there's another publication. It's, gosh, I'm blocking the name of it. It's the Duchamp issue of, comes out of Paris. It came out of Paul Franklin.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Etantone.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sure.
It's a magazine called Etantone, a journal, really. It's very thin.
Yes. Yeah.
There's some pretty nice writing in that also about cage and chess. Sean Bronzel, for example, has a nice piece in that. So you can actually get your hands on kind of these historical documents now, you know, that talk about, you know, things that happened. I mean, Julian Levy was what? 60, 70, 85 years ago now, 86 years.
Yes.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing when you think?
Yes. And actually his foundation is coming out with a 1500 page complete book about Julian Levy and every single show that was at the gallery. And so that's going to be published within the next year or two.
Fantastic.
And it's been in the works for 15 years. So it's the complete book. But Paul Franklin and I sort of collaborated, and I put his essay along with Lowell Cross's in
That's
the
right.
imagery
That's
of chess
right.
book.
That's right.
Yeah, and Paul and I conspired to negotiate the loan of the imagery of chess for the chess pieces piece, so that it could be in the show. And so
Which was no small feat. Didn't you?
No, it was not.
You had to, we're not going to name names, but didn't you have to bring them out, the owners out? I just recall
this. Yes, we invited them to the show and hosted them there.
Yes, and they did come, right? They did.
Happy, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, we were happy to do it. And later when I was in Chicago lecturing at the Art Institute during the Jasper John show, they showed up and were very gracious and all like that. So it was a fun thing all the way around.
Nice. And it's really due to you, Larry, that we have such a beautiful image of the work, because you had it photographed before they shipped it to you. Did you not?
Yes. Yes.
I thought that came from you. And it's just a beautiful picture we wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah. The only thing is that it wasn't color corrected. And the people who photographed it in Chicago didn't tell us that. And so what we reproduced in the book is actually too blue.
Right.
It's more neutral gray. Yeah. Right. But nonetheless, there it is. And, you know, when I examined it, sort of, I blew it up large in the computer and discovered, well, this isn't him just doing calligraphic gestures. This looks like a real piece of music. There's, you know, a treble clef. There's a bass clef. And it follows, though it alternates from white ink on gray to black ink on gray to white ink on gray. It was a through composed piece. And I asked my neighbor, the musician and composer, Andy Tierstein, I said, could you play this? He said, well, it'd be hard reading it this way, but yeah, that's a playable piece. And I contacted Margaret Langtam and sent her the thing. And she.
I've done a show actually for our listening audience. You'll remember it was about 2 months ago, Margaret Langtan and I did a conversation for All Things Cage.
Yeah, and I didn't hear from her. Then at midnight one night, the phone rings and it's Margaret Langtan. And she says, this is a new discovery. This piece has never been recorded or performed. You know, nobody knew it existed. And I have to be the one to do the world premiere. And I said, well, we want to do surrealist films. And it'd be great if you could play the piano, do the piece, et cetera, for that. And within a week, she'd secured funding from the Foundation for Contemporary Art. And we were able to do a DVD and Weekend of Surrealist Films at Anthology Film Archive. And along with the DVD that Brian Brandt of Mode Records,
who we're going to be listening to that very recording at the end of this program. By the way, I just wanted to reiterate something, that the squares that make up this work by John Cage were clearly music. They were traditional notation. What was not clear in just looking at the work of the relationship of one square to another, that's what was not clear. And it was really Margaret at that point, actually the John Cage Trust commissioned her to come in and look at this work that Larry had kindly let us borrow from him, that he had borrowed it from Chicago. And she came in and she made a transcription from looking at it. And sure enough, it was a through composed piece.
Yes. And when we performed, did the world premiere, I did an animation square by square as she played, it was projected on the screen so that you saw exactly the thing unfold. And then Margaret at the last minute insisted that I be on stage turning the pages of her score for her.
I see.
Which was a harrowing experience since I can barely read notation at all. You know, I'm not a great chess player. I'm not a great sight reader. And so it was a harrowing yet, magnificent moment. Yes, sort of being the assistant to the musical magician, Margaret Langtan.
Yes, yes. That's very funny. It's funny though, isn't it, Larry, when you think about it, that work existed for so many decades without anyone noticing.
Well, it was hung in the music room of this family's room next to a grand piano that actually, when Cage was in Chicago, he would use as his rehearsal piano. And, you know, people played the piano and there this thing was on the wall. But it was this thing that sort of musicians only look for music on musical scores. And it seems like art historians only look at things that are paintings as if they're paintings.
Right. No, you're probably right, but.
And there it was in plain sight.
I would add though, that we don't know that no one knew this. What I should have really said is that all those decades, no one spoke about that. You know, there isn't an inkling of anyone making mention of the fact that here's this interesting cage piece, gee, looks like you could play it. Nothing. There was just absolutely nothing, which I find fascinating, because once you know that it's a playable work, and by the way, this work was then, as I said, Margaret Lang Tan transcribed it, so to speak, onto traditional, staff paper, and it's now a published work in Cage's catalog. You can buy a score, which is in essence a transcription of the visual artwork hanging on the wall. So it's just kind of amazing that it hid for so long.
It was a big surprise.
Yeah.
Big surprise, to say the least.
Larry, do you have the original Levy catalog?
There was no catalog, that made it a real forensic project.
This is where my question was going, because it was sort of like, okay, there is one, you have seen it, because you had to do so much work in identifying, who was in the, no one had done this work for you ahead of time.
Well, there was an announcement designed by Duchamp with an image of two of Max Ernst's chess pieces in silhouette, and it listed all 32 artists.
Good.
Arrayed as a chessboard. And so I had that to go by, and then I went through the sales ledger of the Levy Gallery, and that indicated only the pieces that sold, which were few.
Right. And how did you track down the cage?
Well, the cage was a fortunate thing, because it was listed by its title, Chess Pieces, sold for $100. And then sort of in a Duchamp retrospective at the Philadelphia Museum, a catalog there, in the related works, because it was chess pieces, a chessboard by John Cage, there was this little black and white postage stamp size reproduction. And so from there, I proceeded in my detectively way sort of to track it down. So that was fortunate. It was actually a little bit harder at first to find Xenia's thing. And once Dorothea Tanning, she sent me beautiful little pen and ink drawing, because there's a photo of Max Ernst sort of playing on his chess set on this weird modernist table. And I said, oh, is that the Xenia Cage table? No. That was just something we picked up on the street and cleaned up to use. Xenia's table looked like such. And she had made a little ink drawing of it. And then I went through all the Levy auction catalogs, and I located, there it was.
Huh, interesting. By the way, I just wanted to, this is not a correction, but Merce insisted that Xenia, who you're calling Xenia, her name was pronounced Xenia.
Xenia.
Yes.
Okay.
He insisted that that was how you pronounced her name. I have no idea if that's true. Most people say it exactly the way you're saying it, Xenia, but he always said Xenia. You say the X.
Yes. Well, she had an interesting sort of background. Sort of, she was born
totally. Did you meet
Alaska,
her?
Et cetera. I never got to meet her. She had actually passed away before I had done this,
right?
In 96, and I was working on this sort of in 2000. Though, ironically, I was working on another project with someone who had worked at the Jewish Museum as an exhibition designer, and he had to deal with her on a regular basis because she was the preparator. And he sort of described her at length, and then I tracked down sort of her apartment wherein still lived her boyfriend.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember his name, Yuri.
Yuri Danilek, and regrettably, he was ill, and I talked to him on the phone once, and the only time I got to see him was when he was in a hospital bed at Bellevue Hospital, and then he passed away, and so very, very sad.
That's interesting. But he called The Cage Trust. So the Cage Trust went into existence, like in a physical existence in 93, down on Greenwich Street in the West Village in New York. And he called one day. I don't even remember why he called, but I was so happy to hear from him.
Sure.
Because I wanted to see if there was anything of Xenia's left, like the mobiles and anything like that. And he was kind, but not really forthcoming. And I invited him to come and have dinner with me and Merce, which Merce and I did this all the time. It just happened all over. And he said, and I quote, oh, I could never do that. I'm not fancy like you people.
Yes, he was a very idiosyncratic person.
He was like a peasant. He considered himself to be a peasant.
Yeah.
And nothing I said was going to change that I said, really, we're not fancy people, I promise you, you know, but he never did. And then I heard a couple of years later that he had passed away.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, I digressed a little bit, but.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But all of it true.
Well, you know, and Xenia was not an easy person. And
she, Oh no.
She, you know, I had contact information for her, and every now and then I'd get a particular scholar that was working on Cage who just desperately wanted to talk with her. And I would try to dissuade it. You know, I would say, really, you don't want to do this, really? And then they'd pester me so much, I would just give them her phone number and they would call her. And I can't tell you how many of them ended up in tears.
Oh, yeah.
She would say, oh, you want to talk about him?
Right.
I want to talk about me?
Right. Yeah. Well, I did want to talk about her.
She's of course.
Fascinating person.
Right. She was probably waiting for you to call.
Yes. Yeah. But an incredibly creative person.
Yeah.
Regrettable that sort of she didn't continue to receive sort of recognition. But Julian Levy, she made these mobiles out of balsa wood and rice paper and thread.
Yeah.
And they make Richard Tuttle's work seem like cast iron by comparison. Mm. They're very evanescent. It was like sort of trying to install a show of butterfly wings. And Julian Levy lamented that it was impossible to sell them.
Because they were so fragile.
Yeah, they were so fragile. You had to hang them specially. She had Skylar Watts lit her pieces for her show. Because they were calculated to sort of cast shadows in interesting ways. And there's a picture or two of them with their cast shadows sort of, and they're great, but yeah, they're not, as Levy would say, transactable.
Right.
And
right.
So,
no,
yeah.
I get that. That was also true. I'm trying to think of who it was that made, she was a close friend of Cage's and after Cage's death, Cunningham's as well. Lois Long. Lois Long. And Lois Long did those paper mache fanciful animals. They were cats with eight legs or animals that didn't actually exist. And I wanted one desperately because they were just so fanciful and so playful and so beautiful. And Merce was so game. He was going to buy me one of these. And we went to Lois Long's apartment on Fifth Avenue, downtown, way downtown. And he just looked at me and he said, very quietly, he said, I'm not buying you one of these. And I said, why? They weren't all that, you know, but I was a graduate and I didn't have, you know, pot to pee in, as my mother would have said. And Merce said, Laura, this will fall apart in 2 years. He said, it's too frail. It's too, you know, it's not masterfully made.
Right.
We need to keep going. We've only got about, 12, 13 minutes of conversation, but we're doing well. So the show opened. Margaret Lang Tan does the premiere performance of Chess Pieces within the context of that show. She also does Vittoria Rietti's composition called Chess Serenade.
Yes.
And that had been in the original show as well.
Yes. Yeah. It was a framed score on the wall and actually was an excerpt of a much longer piece that just came to light a few years ago in Paris. But anyway, those were the two musical pieces.
Yeah. And then they, as you said, C.F. Peters and Brian Grant. So C.F. Peters picked up the work as a musical work and put it in the catalog. We had the score now. And Brian Grant from Mode Records, who had become the Cage record label at the time, at Cage's insistence, by the way. Cage loved Brian. And Brian knew nothing about making records. And John said, well, you can learn. You can learn.
Yes. Yeah, indeed.
So Brian, that work is both of those works, the Rieti and the Cage, Chess Pieces and Chess Serenade. Yeah. Both of those, along with the sonatas and interludes of Cage, are all on both a DVD from Mode Records and a CD.
Yes.
From Mode. And they're marvelous. Yeah. They're just marvelous.
Yeah. The DVD, sort of, Brian went to great pains to do a beautiful sort of a filming of Margaret explaining Cage's prepared pianos.
Right.
With all of the original stuff.
Yeah.
And that was great. And I think a great educational thing. And then he torturously interviewed Margaret and I at the museum, sitting in front of Cage's chess pieces on the wall, and the two of us discussed that. And then
that's right.
And then he said, "Oh, here, Larry, you have to talk about Xenia Cage's chess table," which I wasn't prepared to do. So, with bated breath, I gave a little description about that, which I think it's a beautiful piece, and lucky that we were able to make the reproduction of it. I feel very strongly that people drop out of the historical record who at the time were influential or very interesting. And Xenia Cage was one of them, and Zanti Shawinski and a number of others. And so because I can, I make authorized museum replicas for exhibition so that the Imagery of Chess show, you really got to see everybody's works and in relation to each other. And you could see, oh, this person's Zanti Shawinski influenced this person and that person, or Xenia Cage's thing influenced this person and that person, so that everybody gets credit for their creative contribution.
Of course.
Yeah. And I feel like that's part of my job, is sort of making sure that everybody gets re-included into the picture,
instead
of they're only being the same five names for each era that, you know, have been able to survive and thrive in the marketplace as you know, transactable works, etc.
Right. You also, I don't want to get too far afield, which you did at the Anthology Film Archive in New York City. Didn't you do a presentation with the world premiere of Chess Pieces, which was the world premiere. It was the world, the concert premiere.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Because it was the first time it was played publicly.
Right.
Whatever so you want to call that.
Well, it was played within the context of the Imagery of Chess Revisited.
It was on a tape loop next to the framed artwork. Then it was recorded by Brian Grant.
So it wasn't live.
Well, at the archive, yes.
No, at the museum.
At the show. No, it was a tape loop.
Got it.
I was thinking headphones.
I misremembered that it wasn't alive at all. So she had recorded it for the museum use, but the performance that you guys both gave at the film archives, where you did, Larry, you did like a blow by blow with each square.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I thought it was important for people to see that the one thing came out of the other thing. That the two were one thing. It's just like, you know, like Cage made this thing and it posited the question, is this a painting? Is this an object, a chessboard, or is it a piece of music? Just as later.
Yes.
Yeah. And later, Jasper Johns sort of made these things that were flags, targets, and alphabets. And so is this a painting? Is it an object, or is it a flag? And is similar sort of template, sort of, you know, questioning sort of the identity of things. And there are multiple sort of potential identities and meanings.
Right.
So in a way, this little chess piece painting slash chessboard was sort of a precursor to these other later things by Johns.
Uh-huh. So interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's Johns, one of his earliest works was painting with the music box, construction with the toy piano. That was, you know, like there was Page's chess pieces painting, which was a painting with music in it. And then Jasper Johns had this construction with a toy piano, which was a collage painting with music in it. And then earlier, sort of Duchamp had done With Hidden Noise, which was this object, this ball of twine sandwiched between two plates. And inside, supposedly, Walter Arnsberg had put a chess piece. So that was an object with a hidden noise, which happened to be a chess piece.
Right. And these guys loved puns. They
loved yes. Yeah. No, that was a driving force. And like I said, you know, with Xenia, sort of, you know, her whole piece was this thing. There's a cage with bars on two sides. There's six different types of chess pieces. There are four members inside going at different angles. And there were four of them, John, Merce, X, Xenia, and Max. And the cross members created X's, which was X for X Xenia and X for being an X cage.
Exactly.
You know, and John sort of was asked later on, sort of at some point, what's the most important advice you could offer? He says, you have to figure out a way of getting out of whatever cage you put yourself into.
Right.
And after studying this Xenia cage table, I thought, what could that have literally meant?
Right.
But anyway, so there we go.
Yeah. I don't know. She was a very interesting woman, but she didn't make life easy on Cage after. I want to say that
I'm sure not.
She finally left. I think it was 46 when she finally left, and she went alone and got the divorce by herself.
Right.
Yeah. So it was a very sad time for all of them.
Yes. Yeah. No, it was totally fraught.
Yeah.
And but anyway.
So Larry, well, this has been just so illuminating. I really encourage people, if they're interested in chess, to take a look at the revisiting book, The Imagery of Chess Revisited. Just get your hands on even a secondary market copy. It's a really beautiful publication.
Yeah.
And you can see replications of, you know, or reproductions of, I don't know, is everything reproduced?
Well, there were about three people that I could not find.
Yeah,
I just that's what totally I couldn't. But I think the substantial story is told and these things are illustrated. And I guess what I was trying to do was make a chess book for art people and an art book for chess people.
Right.
Because there are these two different creative, very creative pursuits. Witness Marcel Duchamp's passion for both. And everybody thinks that, oh, I'm only a chess player, or, oh, I'm an artist, I'm not into chess. And there are intersections, there are many of them, that can be sort of interesting for people to examine. So that's always been my modus as far as organizing things that are about chess and art, is that, you know, I want the chess people to benefit and be stimulated by art things. And I want art people to not be intimidated or put at a distance to the notions of chess, since it has.
Of course, and I think you do that really well.
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna have to stop, Larry, and I really hesitate because you have a lot more to say about your own path with regard to cage and chess. And I'm speaking now of, you know, reunion, essentially. You know, we've got this incredible work for electrified chessboard, essentially a game of chess between two people in which the movement of the game actually generates the ungating and gating of live performance of electronic music. I'm so tempted to have you back.
Well, or, you know, Sarah Rubio Sheridan certainly can offer sort of like insights into that. I mean, she did that fabulous reconstruction.
Maybe you'd be willing to come back and join Sarah. Maybe we'll do it, the three of us.
Sure. Yeah, separately, together, or whatever. But I feel like lucky me that these people made these interesting, intriguing things that, as Ezra Pound said, art is news that stays news.
That's right.
And
that's
so all of these decades later, these things continue to sort of fascinate and...
I would say in some respects, they even take on more meaning as time goes on. That becomes more newsworthy because it picks up the detritus of historical time or something and brings it to the present.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it always takes the general population 50 to 100 years to actually catch up with the significance of artworks or musical compositions or choreography that was truly doing something new.
Right.
And
right.
So, and they say with architecture, it takes about 100 years.
Interesting.
You know? Yeah.
I had a teacher in college who said about music going into the subject of music that a composer wasn't a real composer, wasn't a full-fledged composer until he or she had their third or fourth biography.
Uh-huh.
You know, because the first one never tells a story.
Could be.
You know, it takes two or three, maybe even four biographies to get to something of the complexity of the character of the person.
Well, the other thing is that what I found is six different curators said that they had been interested in trying to do the imagery of Chess Show, but they just couldn't find any information. Mm. And what I found is that they were art historians and they only looked in art historical sources.
Yeah.
And I'm not, and I read detective novels. And so I approach things, I'm told by my research assistant, you approach things forensically. And right. I'm not interested in art history. I'm interested in just what happened. And that has been the mainstay of what I was able to discover.
Yeah, no. And I also think that you are evidence of something that Cage was really kind of emphatic about all the years that I worked with him, was that, you know, education numbed the brain, you know, and education made you think that you knew something that you actually didn't. Stopped the inquisitive self because you know things.
Yeah, it encouraged people to work in only discrete channels.
That's right. That's right.
And and so I'm an independent curator because Orthodox curators and art history people really don't embrace sort of necessarily what one does.
Yeah.
Because, well, that doesn't sound like what the other five people who are experts
that's
say.
Right. Yes.
I mean, with the chess pieces, there were fragments in the New York Public Library of a score for chess pieces. It was partial, but even the people knew that he had done this painting chess pieces, but they were looking at music, so they didn't look at the painting.
Right, right.
You know, and
assuming and people, that if it were
a
viable piece, that someone would have noticed it.
Well, or that he wouldn't have put a viable piece of music in a painting.
Oh,
he
I
would
think
have written it out as a manuscript. Sure.
Don't you think?
He even signed it.
To me, it was like when Margaret said, oh, it's definitely a piece of music. It's like, of course it is.
he even signed it.
Yeah.
Sort of, but it's exactly that sort of channeling of people. The education channels people to look
in one
distinctly
way.
In one area or another.
No, it's true.
And so, you know, the found objects in the ready-mades that Duchamp did were saying, look at the whole world of objects and appreciate their beauty. And Cage, with like 433 and his other pieces that incorporated radio transmissions and stuff, he was saying, listen to the entire world and appreciate its beauty.
Right.
And so they were both encouraging this, you know, expanded and untrammeled sort of, you know, approach to sort of finding beauty. Slogan became, as I was working in this project, find what's strange and beautiful and share it with other people. So that's exactly my specific mandate. And so I have a lot of wiggle room.
Nice. Okay, but, Larry, we've got to wrap up.
Sure.
So we have time to listen to chess pieces.
Oh,
at the close of this program. It's been a pleasure. And I really would like to bring you back perhaps with Sarah, as we said, but perhaps, or in addition, I was going to say that we may bring you back after Sarah Sarah can talk about the premiere of Reunion,
yes,
and all of that, and we'll bring you back to talk about Cage and Kino.
Sure. Yeah, I think that'd be good because that show couldn't have happened without Sarah's work beforehand.
And, of course.
And that was the sort of the great masterwork that she reassembled.
Yeah.
And, I was the beneficiary of that.
And we were too. And,
yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, it's been a pleasure getting to talk with you, Laura.
And I feel the same, Larry, and I'll be in touch. And thank you. Thank you again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now let's listen to Margaret Lang Tan perform John Cage's chess pieces as recorded on Mode Records, Mode 158, John Cage, Volume 34, The Piano Works 7, released in 2006.
Thank you. preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.